Mr. Day, Reel 7. We were talking about the events at Tobruk, the various things that happened. You mentioned the premature that you had to attend once.
There was one in 426 that day, and one crew was number one, I can't remember his name. I remember there was a Gunnar Ward who had a bad injury to his hand. There were about three killed when she burst his shell. There was another incident where Gunnar Doherty was killed, and also Gunnar Lee, Dasher Lee, his name is Dasher Lee. That was just about at the time that we law went out.
What would happen to the bodies? How were the bodies dealt with, or was that not your concern?
Not my concern. I suppose it would be the Graves Commission, the Lord Graves Commission, who would be responsible for the burial in some part. They were taken, I think, taken down to base or something. For those that were bodies that were fit to transport, yes.
Are there any other things you remember about your time in Tobruk?
The German tannoy at night coming over, which played Lily Marlene, sung in German. Some of the regions might well call Willy Anderson. The Germans used to shout, come out and fight you, rats don't use stinking your front calls. Of course, they got more than they bargained for. Many nights when the Australians went out.
Now, one thing you mentioned was a game of cricket you played with Tobruk.
We played a game of cricket against the elements of the Australian division under Morshead, and I had I think it was organised by Lieutenant Joe Conver, the South Moss Hussars, and I had the privilege of opening the innings, and both in the funny and in the real game, I was clean ball first ball on batting.
What was the funny game? Sorry.
Practice. You know, I mean, the bloke ran up to ball. I said, wait one moment. I said, I'm not going to bat him now for a couple of years. Would you give me a sort of a funny? Whereupon he knocked me a little stump out of the ground. He did the same thing the next ball, which was the real commencement of the game. I think the order of the day that sit trenches should be hand. Sit trenches were always hand in, tin arm. It should be at hand at all times in case of the dive bombing raised by the speakers.
Did you have all the gear?
Yes. I think Joe Cumber had it, Lieutenant Cumber. He had somewhere from some regimental equipment.
So he had bat, ball, pads?
Yes.
And what was the what was that? I mean, they wouldn't have a wicket. Who laid that?
There was a matting laid on the desert. It was a hard desert, not far from the team.
And how did the rest of the game go after your disaster?
I can't tell you. I can't remember. It's a long time ago. I don't know whether it was ever finished because of the frequent raids by the Stukas. I mean, again, the cricket normally lasts about 4 hours. And I'm certain, I don't remember that. I know I was clean ball first ball each time. Not for the first time, and not for the last time.
So, any other things you remember? What about the sort of one thing we haven't covered is the sort of insect life. Were you aware of things like scorpions?
Oh, yes. They were there. I don't remember ever treating anybody with scorpion sting or whatever. No.
Were any precautions taken against them or?
No. The mosquito nets weren't worn. They weren't worn down the base in Cairo. But not in Tobruk.
What about the actual jaboa? Did you ever see any, or was it a myth?
The desert rat. No, the desert rat was there. There was a desert.
And were they common in the Tobruk area?
There saw a lot. I don't think the environment of a battlefield would be conducive to any wildlife.
As the siege went on, did you get afflicted with boredom? I mean, because there was not a lot happening for great periods of time.
No, I can't say I did. No. Toward the end of the siege, I had quite a momentous event. It was at the end of the siege, and I took it upon myself to do a walkabout around the various gun positions of the two batteries. And I started off in the morning after 6 for 8, and was off of rum here, a bottle of beer here, with my mates and Bob Foles, various, I remember going, and Pat Bland, and quite a number of the 426 lads too. And eventually I arrived home at the canteen as they were falling in for supper. worse aware. Put it mildly. I remember a dog came running at me and I gave it a rain back, would kick at it and fell on the back. And of course, it got back in the officer's mess to the Dr. Finnegan, Captain Finnegan, that his golden boy was drunk. Which he replied, "Oh, did he? Oh, he never touches the stuff." Well, I was, and I preserved it. Thereupon, he put me on the charge. And I had to go before the adjutant first, that Captain Bourne, and then before Colonel Bill Seeley. Right, left, cap off, and my guard left me, and I was left in front of the Colonel, and he said, "What have you been up to?" And I said, "Well, I thought the book sort of seen it ended, but I was, went off celebrating, I had a drink here and a drink there," and he said, "Won't do it again, will you?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Right, I'll fall out. When you next leave?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, come and see me." No problem, no, I was all right. So that was one of the things that I did. I often remonstrated with Finnegan in the years afterwards, especially when he came to the South Knots for hearing, and he said, "You know, because you didn't save any for me." But I think it was because that I got such a reputation, or he gave me such a write up in front of these other officers about his golden boy and he sort of let him down. Anyway, so I did it, and that's it.
Was Seeley popular with the men?
Yes, yes. He had a plate in his head, which was a silver plate, which covered part of the skull that he'd received in a hunting accident. And it was my duty to go on and clean it and put it right. I remember one incident at Tobruk that he had a bad back. And the doctor said, "Now take this bottle of Lynn Terrapins, which were rubbing oils, and give the colonel a good massage. No doubt you'll get your third stripe." So full of glee, off went across the desert. Here a massage. "How do you feel, sir?" "Oh, much better. That's great. Thank you very much. Great." The next morning, Finnegan said, "For God's sake, what have you done with the girl, Harry? She can't get out of bed." "Oh." "So, well, that's gone. That's gone. The stripe's gone." "Well, I'll take a bottle, take some." Fermentation, plasmic kaolin, anti-suggestion, put a poultice on his back. Put me through and then find the stove, heat of the water, and cut blood and kale and poultice, and he eventually recovered all right. It does sometimes, if you overdo it in massage, you get the opposite, the reverse effect.
But he was a fair officer from the sound of it, from the way he treated you,
much,
anyway.
Very much so, yes. Yes, he was a good officer, I thought.
Well, any other officers that came to your mind, particularly as good officers?
Captain Slynn.
What was so good about Slynn?
Very brave man. He got the MC. Captain Barber got the MC. And Gary Birkin, a very good man. I can't speak any of them. They were all to my mind.
Did the Birkin brothers have a particular influence? I mean, there were the cousins, the Birkin family. They seem to be almost at the centre of the regiment in the history, you know.
That is true. The Birkins were attached and concerned with the 425 battery, both in the First World War and the Second World War. I think it was a father and son affair. Although Peter was a cousin of Gary and Ivor. Gary and Ivor were brothers. And as regards the 426 battery, of course, it was the Barbers. Captain Major Bill Barber and his brother Colin, I don't think it was his cousin Colin Barber, who was shot out of hand because he wouldn't give his revolver.
And these officers, in your view, they were all competent and good officers. As you came across them, they did their job well.
Yes, I speak, I suppose, somewhat apart, being a medical lord. They are not in the immediate combatant area with regards to, say being a gun sergeant or a sergeant major of the troop. I wasn't a combatant as such, so I can only speak as I found them as men and person on the way they reacted under fire, which I think that's all. We all saw each other under fire, and to my mind they were all right. But as I say, I speak as a, not as a combatant, concerned in the actual activities at that time and at that place where they were, and ended with their own troop.
What about the senior NCOs? Were there any characters amongst them you particularly recall?
There was Sergeant Major Lake, who was a great guy, and Robinson, Mays, Smedley, Patland, Barnes, Raelis, Old Falls, They're all good lads.
Now, what about the breakout? Do you remember anything about that? Because there was quite a lot of activity and some casualties.
There was a lot of heavy fire by Rommel just before the broke out. There was a lot of shell fire and super raids. But as regards to the actual breakout, apart from the casualties which I have stated, to my mind, there was nothing great about it.
So with you, most of the casualties you had to deal with at that stage came at Knightsbridge, that before then you'd not had a lot of casualties.
We hadn't had a lot of casualties.
Except for the period when you'd been attached to the casualty clearing station.
Right.
Other than that, you hadn't had an awful lot of...
Not an awful lot, we hadn't. Although the amount of bombing and shelling that we had sustained during the Merton II campaign and the Tobruk siege, we didn't have an awful amount of casualties.
What were the main sort of wounds you'd been dealing with at Tobruk? Were they actually from artillery or from bombing or...
We lost several men by dive bombing. Two were mortally wounded. I remember them evacuated from the RAP quickly. Quite a few by shell fire towards the breakout. Many were killed. Some of was killed outright. Doherty.
Was there any difference? I mean, I can't tell, but was there any difference between a wound? A shrapnel wound and a bomb splinter wound or a bomb wound, did they have any different characteristics?
No. Just depends how both were concerned by pieces of metal, namely shrapnel flying, exploding, and bursting.
It made no difference how it was fired.
No.
You wouldn't be taking any bullet wounds, I presume. The unit would be on...
The only man that I recall getting injured by a bullet wound was Paddy Perry, who was injured on the 27th of May. The following that is the only man I can recall out of hand. All the others were due to bomb splinters or shell splinters.
Now, the breakout, did your regimental aid post go forward with the unit?
No, it never moved until the battle had gone. The battle went upwards and we were recalled as a unit.
So, when they went forward to attack the Tiger Post and Jack and Jill, you stayed at the regiment?
That's right, yes. And of course, when the breakout took place, when the 8th Army moved up, ultimately to Alagaela, we, the South Mosses Lodge, we went back to base.
So you went back to Hag after the...
To Hag, yes, which was an army base camp. And Finnegan, Dr. Finnegan, was taken to hospital to have an operation on his piles. And I, after having been in conference with Finnegan and another doctor, was put in charge of medical sick parades, but with close association with the other doctor of another unit. And I sort of said, well, whatever happens, I can not take on more than I can manage. Anything that's follicular tonsillitis could be this after a scrape, and if I think, okay, I'll send him off. And it's just a normal thing, you know, that you do get. I'll see if I've got headaches after a binge morning. My tooth taken out.
So what happened then?
Well, Finnegan, he left the regiment, and we moved to... John Finnegan left the regiment and they moved to Sidi Bish, and the regimental medical officer was taken over by Captain McFarlane.
Now what was he like?
Scotland, competent, very good doctor, competent doctor, who did great work in Masonic Knightsbridge. We had one...
Did you get on with him initially as well as... I mean, you got on obviously well with Finnegan. Did you find yourself getting on well with him?
Yes. You see, I had no knowledge of desert sores and things like that. And as I say, it was sort of trial and error with desert sores. You had to give one bloke, reacted to one treatment, one drug, and another man reacted to another one. And he left that to me, because then he had no experience with desert sores. We had one, Kenny Flint came to us, coughing blood, I remember. And of course, he told me not to mention this. Of course, I had to, it's my job, to mention it for a doctor. And he was evacuated and he had TB, and I believe he died in South Africa. And that was a terrible thing. He was a big fight on my territory.
And anything else about Sidi Bishop? Because from then, in March, you went to Beni Yusuf.
Beni Yusuf. In March, so he took Beni Yusuf, which was a camp, an army camp outside Cairo, and we were equipped. £25 was a new equipment. Of course, then we had these new tanks, ground tanks, which was the first time we'd had a comparable tank with the German Mark III. And we didn't stop there very long.
Were you still in your two trucks, or had you got any more modern?
We had just two trucks. We had the 1500 weight and the 3-tonner.
Did it make any difference when, I mean, there was a formation of a 520 battery at that time? That you were with regiment. Would that make any difference to you? Did you get any extra medical personnel?
No.
So it was still just the...
Just us, yes.
And did you get any more equipment at all? Or any other...
Medical equipment.
Or were any new treatments or medicines appearing that you hadn't had in, say, Tobruk or Mercer? Before you went up to Knightsbridge?
No. There was one thing that I think I told you that we did. We invented for some paint to paint the 3-tonner covered wagon with Red Cross, with two Red Crosses on it, to be identified to the enemy as protected personnel, medical personnel, but we never helped the paint. So we needed off a special treatment. We got shells, not shells.
Do you remember, the move up during that spring into the Knightsbridge area? They were training all the way up. Do you have any memories of that? It wouldn't affect you so much, I don't think.
It wouldn't affect me. I know that my thoughts were, this is the third time, and I don't know why, although we got all this new equipment, and everything was terrific, you know, the new ground tanks, and new 25-pounders, and new trucks, new formations had come along, and we expected really to take one along for the last time, and we've got. But you know, I sort of had a feeling that this wasn't going to be, so I don't know why. Yeah.
Right, so the first, I mean, you moved up. Could you describe where you moved up to, so that we could set the scene for the events that followed, from starting with May the 27th, which is when 520 Battery was attacked?
Where we moved up to. Are we recording? To an area south of Tobruk, to a place which was known as Knightsbridge, near Bir Hakeim. And from there until the 27th of May, we were mainly training, reforming, regrouping, and everything seemed obscure. It was known some time in advance that Rommel was preparing a big assault with his 500 tanks and his 3 Panzer divisions, the 21st, 15th and the 90th Light. This was known right throughout all the higher circles. And it was strange to me that at that time, although the wireless message apparently had been received, on the 26th, the night of the 26th of May, that the attack was about to begin, that sufficient means were done to repulse this attack, which of course overran completely the 520 battery, the compressed 520 battery, killing the majority of the guns.
Now, what were you doing during this? I mean, you'd be back at...
We were part of the 22nd Armed Brigade. And the 425 and 426 battery were, at that time, elements of the attack. We were performing boxes with so many 25-pounders, so many anti-tank guns, gun carriers, infantry, and, of course, tanks, ground tanks, and, of course, in cases of stores. We had guns by now.
And you yourself would be with the regimental aid post, which would be with the regimental headquarters at that time, would it?
Well, we hadn't set up a regimental aid post because we were still in transit.
So you'd be moving with the regimental headquarters.
Two trucks. in the two trucks. The big truck, the three-tonner, the canvas covered and four stretchers in it to either side. And our truck contained the driver, the doctor, and myself.
So your vehicle was travelling with 425, 426 and the regimental headquarters were all together, and 520 were detached when this happened.
They were detached, and of course they had the full brunt of the battle, which started on the 27th of May.
And the rest of you were all together?
We were all together some distance away.
And what happened during, were you called to go and help?
No, this is a terrible thing about it. Sort of every, when a unit, a regiment or a unit got attacked, it seems that the others sort of walked off. Which was not, and I don't think it's specifically our fault, it was the fault possibly the people who were organising it.
But as the medics, were you not called to go and help with the casualties?
No, because it was an overwhelming thing. It was a very quick, sudden thing. They had so many AP shells and HE shells. Of course, there was very few in comparison AP armour piercing shells. What were HE shells? And it was only with an armoured piercing shells because you're not a Mark III or Mark IV tank out, and they didn't have time. They weren't dug in. I think it's fair to say that 25 pounds and dug in like it was at Tobruk properly could knock tanks out, but not being dug in, they had no cover. Although they did knock a great number of tanks out, but they were overwhelmed very quickly.
So there was no call for the medics to go to deal with the casualties?
No, there was no time. There was no time for it. The thing was so sudden and over.
Did you see the scene after the event?
No, I didn't.
Now, in your notes, which I'll refer to from time to time, you mentioned there were two major casualties you dealt with. Padre Parry, that was the first.
Yes.
What happened?
He had machine gun bullets through the windscreen of the vehicle he was travelling in, which had, of course, entered his chest, and he was evacuated.
So, how had he come to come into your hands?
He was with the 520 battery.
And who brought him back?
I can't remember the name of the man. I think it was two or
but
three.
He was brought in.
He was brought in a truck, yes.
And what state was he in?
I mean, he was highly shocked. We had to give him morphine and tetanus injections, and he was evacuated.
Was there any practical treatment you could do to a chest wound at your level of the medical chain?
No, and you put shell dressings around it. Nothing more you could do. Morphine. And the other was this officer left in Tripoli with a compound fracture of the humerus.
Now, he wasn't a South...
No, he was in North Lazars. They were an anti-tank unit. And the humerus was stuck to a stretcher. My blood, which had exuded, and it was immobilised. It was splintered and stuck flung into the stretcher canvas, which... I left, maggots were creeping out, which was a very good thing.
But that wouldn't be then, would it? That would be later?
Later.
When you met him in hospital later?
No. I didn't meet him in hospital until 6 months later.
So this had all happened already when you saw him?
Yeah.
Sorry then.
He was brought to me, I think it was about, it was on the 26th of May, and he was not long before...
27th of May.
27th of May, not long before he was sent back to base.
So all this had happened, the maggots had happened almost...
Before he'd come, when that happened, I don't know.
And you were saying that was a good thing. Could you just explain on tape why that was a good thing?
Maggots, yes, they eat the pus, they eat the discharge, and they exude calcium carbonate, which acts as an antiseptic to the wound. And of course, the mere fact the thing was that the wound was, the humerus was stuck to the canvas stretcher was a good thing because it was immobile. It must have happened. Possibly, I may be a little wrong here, it might have happened during the 26th and before the 28th of June. But he was evacuated.
Of May. So it had perhaps been like that for two or three days when you saw.
Yeah.
So how did you actually treat him?
Apart from giving him morphine, I left it as it was. It was quite immobile. There was no secondary infection.
That was because the blood had stiffened and it was...
congealed and stuck to the canvas of the stretcher. And he was taken back to base, and then of course they are, say 6 months later in Caserta, in Italy, I met him. His arm had been saved, it wasn't amputated. And that was due to Captain McFarlane pleading the Italian medics.
Later on?
Later on. Terra North Zars, we had compound fracture and illness. He must have been injured, wounded, on the 27th of May. He appeared at our regimental aid post sometime later, about the 1st to the 5th of June. His arm, the humerus, was stuck to the stretcher, immobilised.
You mentioned that, yeah.
And he was eventually, after the battle of the Colne on the 5th and 6th of June, evacuated with the other wounded that we had by Italian ambulances.
So he was still with you? He was evacuated by the Italians, not the British?
Yes.
Another thing that you mentioned is that you had to deal with some British who'd been taken prisoners by the Italian and then the Germans and then escaped.
Yes.
And you treated them for various things, shock.
Yes.
What was that about? Do you remember any of them?
Yes, there was Bill Hutton. There were quite a lot more. I cannot remember the names. It's quite an acute thing. It didn't take very long. I mean, they reported in. They were under stress and shock and were treated.
How would you treat that?
There was one or two minor wounds which had a spot of morphia. The others were given sedatives, sedation.
Which sedative would you be using then?
Well, we used powder and aspirin.
So not strong sedatives?
No, we were looking morphine tablets. God knows what they're actually. Well, you stick that under the tongue. You could tie morphine tablets. And they were sent back and from the immediate scene of the battle.
So that was the end of the 27th, you know, as far as it affected you. What happened between then and the actual battle in June?
Well, this is it. We used to describe, we sort of stood 2 in the morning and we just did nothing, just swung up and down the desert for no apparent reason.
Inside the Knightsbridge box?
Right. Nobody seemed to know what to do. The historians have written various details of the desert battle. But had Rommel been attacked during that time, between the 27th of May, as we were told by the many had been taken prisoner and escaped, that he was in serious difficulty with supplies. Had he been attacked, so the historians write, between the time of the 27th of May and the 5th of June, it might have been a different story, but we just sort of swung up and down and did nothing.
When you stood to, were you digging in the guns properly?
No, the brigade assembled. At night time, we lined. Dispersed in the daytime, we marched and we went.
So when you lagered, would you actually lager as in digging in, or was it just a.
Just dispersed. If you wanted to, okay, you did a slip trench by the side of your vehicle.
But the guns weren't dug in positions or anything like that?
As far as I know, no.
So they weren't expecting immediate attack?
Yes, they were always a flood. I suppose so. I mean, I was medic. I didn't pay much attention to the activities of the fighting unit. That was their sort of the officers' concern with this. That was their problem. We were there, you know, casualties. But as far as I remember this very well. Nobody seemed to know. Everybody every day was saying, "Well, I wonder what you're going to do." We seem to be doing nothing, and we could hear distant. Gunfire and the distant battles taking place.
And you knew what had happened to 520 by then?
Oh, yes, because these men had been taken prisoner and had returned to the main two batteries and described the appalling things that happened to them, been over months.